Thanks, Albert. Back up. When you study Srimad Bhagavatam carefully, Bhagavad Gita also, there are clusters of verses that express a theme, message. And this cluster, that cluster, this message makes an overall chapter, theme. Generally. So, we covered the first set of verses, 17 through 20. Actually, the prayers begin 18 through 20. So you have this paper. You just... In the beginning, Kunti is receiving the Lord and chanting his glories. She's identifying his supreme, transcendental, absolute position. The cause of all causes, who cannot be seen by ordinary persons. She counts herself amongst the ordinary persons, although she's already indicated or disclosed that she's not. By her earlier words. And she also by the assistance that Prabhupada is giving us in the purports, it makes it clear. She has some issue or some uncertainty about his all-pervasive and his localized features. She's not the only one. There are lots of people that can't comprehend different statements in the scripture or different understandings of the nature of God. Is God all-pervasive or is God localized? Because they seem mutually contradictory, materially they are. I was prompting some of you yesterday to recall where in Bhagavad Gita Krishna is identified as avyayam. I'm just curious, did anybody do a little research? No, I just received, did anyone else give thought to that? Okay, go ahead. Do we have a Bhagavad Gita here? Does anyone have Bhagavad Gita here? Does anyone else have one in their room? You have one right here? Look at this. Here comes one Bhagavad Gita. Thank you. Go ahead. Anuttama. Say it again. This is 7:24 Bhagavad Gita. Mama avyayam. Mama avyayam. Param bhavam. They don't know my higher nature. Ajananto mamavyayam. So this is describing Krishna's parambhavam. He's avyayam. Avyaktam vyaktam apanam. Manyate mam abodhaya. Unintelligent men who do not know me perfectly think that I, the Supreme Personality of God, it was impersonal before and now have assumed this personality. Manyate. they think of me in that way. Amyaptam, Yaptim. We've heard this. The unmanifested became manifested. Krishna is the manifested feature of the unmanifested, which is primordial. Well, avbuddhaya. That understanding is not intelligent. They do not know my higher nature, which is, so his form is avyayam, inexhaustible, imperishable, and adutama, supreme, or he gives it, here's the finest. Now, there's several verses I did a little research to, from the fourth chapter. Krishna describes the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita as avyayam. And in text 13, should have brought my book. Chaturvarnamaya shrishtam guna karma vivagasha tasya kartaram abhimam vidya akartaram avyayam. Krishna is describing that he has created the four varna system, chaturvarnamaya shrishtam. This is based on guna and karma. He does so although he's the non-doer. Dasya kartaram apimam vidhi akartaram. He did it, but he didn't do it. He created it, but he's the non-doer. He did it by his age, by the agency of his energies, although he himself did nothing. And this is a feature of his avyayam. His energies are unlimited and can do anything. And through his energies, he does things, although he himself doesn't do anything. This is his part of his transcendental nature. Just trying to give you a picture of, well, several things. One of those things is when Kunti is addressing Krishna as avyayam, what does that mean? So, it's by taking the application of that word in different ways that helps us get a sense of what Kunti actually understands about Krishna, what she means when she says Krishna is avyayam. 7.13 Trivir Gunamayar Bhavayar Devi Sarvamidam Jagat Mohitam Navijana Timami Vyakparam Avyayam. Deluded by the three modes of material nature, that you're, while trying to be, to keep Krishna thought in your mind, right down to the moment where you sit down and do your practical work, Krishna thought may be there, and then hours later, oh yes, I'm finished with my work, and Krishna thought was just gone. Something like that. So, the attraction for Krishna, loving attraction for Krishna, thought of Krishna comes just from hearing his name. In relation to this, Krishnaya Vasudevaya Devaki Nandanaya, that verse, Prabhupada expressed that his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, as we know, he did a lot of publication work. So he would, in many cases, edit the public things before they were put into the publication. And Prabhupada said, on many occasions, he would simply glance over to see how many times Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Govinda, and if it was there lots of times, he would say, publish it. Prabhupada said. because the spiritual transcendental benefit is there just by hearing the name. In this way, the form of the Lord appears in the mind by the hearing and chanting process. And conversely, any other form, just like the deity worship form of the Lord or the Arjuna process, according to our Acharya, specifically Jiva Goswami says, it must be accompanied by chanting. What's deity worship without chanting? The Lord is not pleased. So before the puja is done, there's chanting. After the puja is done, there's chanting. And that's our process. Our process is this Bhagavad process. So even with the, while the deity worship process is so important, the hearing and chanting process is most important. And therefore, Prabhupada introduced us to hearing and chanting first. And in course of time, through purification, then the Arjuna process, accompanying the deity, accompanying the hearing and chanting process, not the other way around. You understand my point? The primary thing is hearing and chanting. And Kunti's prayers give us wonderful hearing and chanting subject matter. Okay, so the next verse we'll chant together. This begins another cluster of verses. Yatha Rishikesha Kalina Devaki Yangsena Ruta Chitram Sucharpita We have different melodies going here. Vimochitaham cha samatma cha vibho. Toya eva na tena mohor vipatkanat. O Rishikesha, master of the senses, and Lord of lords, you have released your mother Devaki, who was long imprisoned and distressed by the envious King Kamsa, and me by my and my children from a series of constant dangers. So this section has, is the danger section. It's the helplessness because of difficulty and danger. Kunti is very experienced in this area of life. Some of us are also. And Kunti, she's now going to explain what's the role of this and how does one properly address distress and danger and difficulty. Why does Krishna, this is a common question, I would say it's in the top 20 on the hit parade of questions asked of sadhus. Why does people, it's, my friend is so good, or and why are they put in difficulty, or this innocent child, why the difficulty, or why difficulty, or why difficulty? And all those people over there, they're sense gratifiers, and looks like they're having a good time, and they're not even devotees. That kind of question. You've different varieties on the theme. So Kunti is helping us understand why specifically good people, like devotees, are sometimes we find they have distress. The idea is that distress or difficulty, they usher in a feeling of helplessness. And in that feeling of helplessness, taking shelter of the Lord is there because, whoops, all those other shelters are now gone. So, this is expressed in this little handout that I provided you with. Danger and difficulty bring helplessness, which gives rise to remembrance of Krishna, plus a mood of exclusive shelter in Him. And one who has no material shelter, no shelter but Krishna, that person can feelingly pray to Krishna. That's the five verses. It's the theme. So I'm just now going to cover the first one. She specifically, in the Sanskrit, Tvayaiva natena muhur vipad ganat. This vipad means, it's the term that's used in this series of verses, meaning a problem, a danger, a difficulty. Vipad ganat. A series of vipads, a series of difficulties. She points to, oh, so, but you're the Lord, you're the Natha that gives deliverance from a constant series of difficulties that myself and my sons have been put through. She points to Devaki. She had a really big one in the form of Kamsa. And from the time that she was married, Kamsa was at her throat with his sword, or in jail, or killing her children, or... And Krishna relieved Devaki of that problem, the Kamsa problem. In contrast, Kunti, she had a whole series of problems, not just one. And, you know, they were formidable personalities, not just small fries compared to Kamsa. The whole burden of the earth was filled with demoniac kings, and many of them had enmity towards the Pandavas. But Krishna delivered again and again. And in the process of that deliverance, each time there was a great difficulty, the Pandavas had a wonderful opportunity. Adversity is an opportunity. Nice phrase. A devotee sees adversity as an opportunity. Adversity, different, difficult conditions. It's an opportunity to see Krishna, to take shelter of Krishna, to call out to Krishna to please help. And without that adversity, complacency. Prabhupada described that his Guru Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, had a policy. He would always keep his temples in poverty. If at any time they got to the position where they were financially okay, he would give them some service that would drain their finances and put them in a situation where they had to call out to Krishna. Because he didn't want his disciples to feel comfortable. Plus, whatever resource Krishna sends is meant for expanding Krishna consciousness. The material, from the position of material consciousness, one wants to always maintain a materially comfortable and secure position. It's one of the things that we're finding in America. There are many persons now taking up Krishna consciousness in America who don't want to surrender in a temple, but they like to practice Krishna consciousness in their materially secure situation. More and more, it's like that. Some persons, but it's many persons are actively embracing practices of devotional service in their situation. Anyway, I don't want to go too much into this, but in discussions with Bhakti Vikash Maharaj, he's been studying Bhakti Siddhanta's life, like, you know, for years. writing a book. But the book just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger because there's so much on Bhaktisiddhanta's life. And one of the things during Bhaktisiddhanta's times, he encountered the same thing that Prabhupada encountered when he first started preaching, and that was that parents were very attached to their children getting materially secure situations. As I'm sure a number of you are very intimately aware of. So, Bhaktisiddhanta was very firm on bringing people to the stage of taking shelter and renouncing worldly life. He told me one story that one young man had joined his ashram and he was, Bhaktisiddhanta traveled as a sannyasi to the different moths. One time he was visiting in one moth and it was told that the parents of that young fellow were coming to see him. They wanted to take him away. So Bhaktisiddhanta had the boy hide under his bed. And his parents came to, you know, demand to see their son. They said, he's not here. You can search everywhere. He's not here. And the boy's right under the bed. Apparently it was the young boy later told the story to Bhakti Vikash Maharaj, the first-hand experience of... Because Bhaktisiddhanta was saying, this is transcendental. We can't do such things. But for him to say, it was a transcendental purpose to achieve, a higher purpose, because without persons giving their full-time service to spreading Krishna consciousness, how will it spread? And this is the urgent necessity of society, is to bring spiritual value and bring Krishna consciousness into the lives of people. By a full-time dedicated, the Gaudiya Math spread on the strength of that renunciation that Bhaktisiddhanta had and how he inspired that renunciation in others. And Krishna consciousness spread widely during his time. Anyway, that's a side note. Why was it that Krishna, being the shelter of his surrendered devotees, that he allowed Devaki's children to be killed, but he gave protection to Kunti's children? And the answer was, Prabhupada supplies that here. Devaki had a husband. And so, her protection was in the form of her husband. Kunti, her husband had died. Her protection was in the form of her sons. So Krishna protected her sons. Now there's other transcendental explanations to all of this, but that's the one that Prabhupada provides here. And the difficulties that Kunti was put in was taken by her as an act of special mercy from Krishna. Special mercy in the form, specifically, we're going to hear in this section, this famous prayer where she asks for the calamities again and again. But because the calamity provided helplessness, and helplessness meant calling out very intensely for Krishna, which meant Krishna would come. Now, all the problems are gone. So Krishna's leaving. Better to have the calamities than have Krishna than no calamities and no Krishna. Bring the calamities. Now, who thinks like that? Please, Krishna, bring some calamity. Nobody thinks like that. Kunti thinks like that. So the next next verse. My dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poisoned cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from the vicious assembly, from suffering during our exile in the forest, and from the battle where great generals fought. And now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashvatthama. So this continues from the previous verse. This is a little inventory of the series of dangers. Mahur Vipad Ganat, a series of constant dangers. So they go chronologically. And if you're all ready, we can do a little Mahabharat exploration and just narrate some of these, just expand the stories one by one. I understand this group likes Mahabharat very much. Maybe more than Srimad Bhagavatam. I don't know. I like Srimad Bhagavatam more, but here Kunti is disclosing some Mahabharat episodes that are not expanded in Srimad Bhagavatam. But it's nice, specifically from the Bhagavatam perspective, to understand Kunti, what she's been through. And we could say it at the end of this, all this Mahabharat narration, what Kunti has been through, and to say what she's saying now, let it happen again and again. It's really a substantial statement, because we can read about all this excitement, but when you're going through the things that they went through, it's terrible. She's a mother. This first one is her son was poisoned twice. The situation, so in comes Mahabharat. The situation was that Dhritarashtra was of the three brothers, he was firstborn. And normally, the firstborn son would inherit the property of the father. In this case, he would become the king. But because he was blind, he was not able to become king. And so the second son, Pandu, was to become king. In fact, he was crowned king. He became king. Because this was a necessity. Because Santanu was already deceased when all this happened, and Chitrangada and Vijayadeviriya, they were also deceased. And there was no son to continue the lineage except by Vyas producing children through the two remaining queens, the queens of Vijayadeviriya, Amba and Ambika. Ambika and Ambalika. So these three were born. And as they were growing up, it was known that Pandu would become king. Although he treated his elder brother like a younger brother treats an elder brother, with great, great, great respect. And they had very, very close, affectionate relationship. Although the younger brother was to become the king. And Bhishma, being the brother, he was actually the elder brother of these other three. He made arrangements for their marriages. And he considered that a suitable wife for Dhritarashtra was Gandhari. Because it was, if Gandhari received this benediction, that she would have 100 sons. And it was foretold by Vyas that Dhritarashtra would have 100 sons. Well, good arrangement. And when the Gandhara, the king of, which is now Kabul, was approached, he thought it was a good arrangement. Gandhari's brother didn't think it was a good arrangement. Shukuni. In fact, he resented that this arrangement had been made. But he couldn't say anything, his father, so the arrangement was made. Gandhari became the wife of Dhritarashtra. And as soon as she heard that her husband, to-be, was blind, that's when she blindfolded herself. So she would not be in a superior position than her husband. He can't see, but I can see. To keep herself in that chaste and humble position in the presence of her husband. Dhritarashtra had a remaining hope. The remaining hope was that if in his marriage with Gandhari, his children were born first, his sons were born first, they would become the king following Pandu. And the pregnancy of Gandhari came first before Pandu's wives. Long description of why it took. Pandu was unable, there was a curse upon Pandu because of his shooting some stag while engaged in intercourse. It was a yogi and his wife. He cursed him. You should not have fired upon me in this condition. So I curse you that if you have union with a woman, instantly you will also die. So he was unable to produce children. Then Kunti disclosed with great embarrassment this benediction she had gotten from Durvas Muni. And right away she regretted even saying it because Pandu said, you should do this. And she was saying, how can I do this? I'm your wife. How can I have union with another man? And a very intriguing dialogue between the two, one that would bewilder an ordinary person. Why was the religious thing to do? Which is the exceptional circumstance and not at all an ordinary circumstance. In any case, so Yudhisthira was conceived, and meanwhile Gandhari was expecting her pregnancy to deliver a child, but it went past the 9th month, 10th month, 11th month, 12th month. Then Yudhisthira was born, the firstborn son. And so Gandhari hammered her abdomen with her fist, and a lump of flesh appeared instead of a child. And so she didn't know what to make of that. She consulted. Who did she consult? Vyas? Vyas? Vyas indicated, no problem. Just take that lump of flesh, divide it in 100 pieces, put each piece in a pot, leave them there for a year, and then uncover the pot. Voila. You'll have 100 children, just as it was foretold. So she did what he said, and the first pot the cover was taken off of was Duryodhana and all these terrible omens and jackals belching fire and asses braying and all these. And Vidura said, this means that this child is a bad child. He'll be the ruination of the society. We should abandon him. How can I abandon him? He was attached from the very beginning. So, some time passed, and the Pandavas, one by one, all five were born. And then, as the curse was given, Pandu died when uncontrolled lust overtook him, and he instantly died when having union with his wife Madri. And so for all this time, the idea is that the Pandavas are growing up outside of the royal palace vicinity because Pandu disliked that situation. Although he was king, he preferred that situation, the comforts of the royal palace. But when he died, then a decision was made between the two wives. Madri would enter into the funeral pyre. Her husband, Kunti, would continue to give protection to the children. And she, not having a husband, she then came back to the royal palace. And when she came back to the royal palace, everybody was happy. The Pandavas were happy to be back. Everyone was happy to have them back. Everyone was happy to see Kunti. Gandhari was honored by the Pandavas as like their mother. Everything was very nice for a little while. Until Bhima, whose bodily stature was towering above everybody in his physical stature, just young men, like, you know, I don't know exactly the age, but something like teenagers. Bhima was just too much. His strength. They would be sporting like boys would sport, and he'd toss one of the other boys, and toss another one of the boys. Humiliate and shame them. So much so that the natural envy of Duryodhana came out. We gotta do something with this Bhima. So he took the second brother, Dushasana, he's brother number 2 out of 100. Not too much behind Duryodhana in his character either. And they did their little conspiracy. I learned this one from Bhima. This means gossiping. We got to get rid of Bhima. He's too much. And Dushyasana said, I'm thinking the same thing. The very next day, the plan was to poison him. So it was announced, Duryodhana announced, let us go. Dhritarashtra has created such a wonderful sporting palace for us near the river. Let us go and have sporting events together. Yes, let us go. Let us sport and have fun. They're young boys. And so they got on their royal chariots with great ceremony, clattering all the way to this marble building, 7 stories tall, with golden spires, with flags, and many, many rooms with coral and ivory furnitures embedded with jewels, beautiful royal setting. And the first thing on the agenda was a big feast, specially prepared in the back room by Duryodhana, poisoned with enough poison in Bhima's plate to kill 100 men. And another name for Bhima is Vrikodar. Voracious eater. He ate and ate and ate. And Duryodhana and Dushasana are looking and waiting, and nothing happened. Kept eating and eating and eating and eating. And the feast was over, and it's time for their sporting. So they went to the river, and Bhima went in splashing and tossed people around like they're pieces of cotton. And after pushing them into the water, throwing them into the water, he'd jump in and create waves that would just practically drown them. His body was so big. And Duryodhana was pride. And Dushasana was right behind him. He was so powerful, so strong. And this went on for the whole day. And at the end of the day, Bhima was feeling a little tired. So I think I'll just lie down here by the river, take a little nap, and you all can go back to the house. I'll meet you later. The poison was showing a little effect. So he had a little snooze. And while he was in his little snooze position, Dushasana and Duryodhana came and found him there. And they tied him up very tightly with ropes, looked in all directions, and pushed him into the river, thinking he's dead, and now we'll never see Bhima ever again. But they didn't know was that the celestial Nagas coming from the underworld, they found Bhima's body in the river, and they began biting him with their poisonous fangs, and it was the exact antidote for this same poison that had been given by Duryodhan. So the poison effect was neutralized. There you go. And then Bhima regained external consciousness in Nagaloka, looked around and saw all these snakes, and just expanded his body, burst all the ropes, and started fighting with the snakes and throwing the snakes around. And the remaining snakes, when they saw so many snakes being killed and tossed around, they went right to the king of the snakes, whose name is Vasuki. Same as the Vasuki in the churning of the milk ocean. He was the churning rope. Vasuki. Our master, please do something at once. This human has come into our vicinity and he's killing so many Nagas. Only you can give us protection, please, oh great hero. Save us. So Vasuki, who amongst the Nagas, they have different mystical abilities. One of them is to assume different forms. He assumed a human-like form, got up from his throne, requested Arka, one of his chief ministers, to come with him to go inspect the situation. They found Bhima, powerful Bhima, looking in all directions. And at once Arka recognized who Bhima was. Mahabharata explains that in a previous life, Arka was in the realm of the humans, and he was the great-grandfather of Kunti. So he knew who Kunti was, and he recognized this big, burly Bhima must be her son. So he went up and embraced his great-great-grandson, Bhima. Welcome! Welcome to Nagaloka! So nice for you to come here. And Vasuki immediately joined in the same spirit and said, he's related to you. This is wonderful. Let us make offerings of jewels and various precious valuables. And Arka said, no, what would be suitable for Bhima is something to eat. And the nicest thing that we have is our special rasa. Let us bring him some naga rasa. So Vasuki made the arrangements and big pots of this celestial herbs that are put together in a certain way that it gives incredible strength and mystic powers. So Bhima, the voracious eater, sat in front of many pots, picked up one of them in one gulp. He downed the whole thing. The Nagas had never seen anything like that before. And he took another one. And it was gone. And another one, and another one, and another one. The Nagas were completely amazed at his capacity to take this rasa. And then Bhima started feeling a little tired. He said, I need a little rest. So they made a resting place, and he rested for 1 week. Powerful stuff. At the end of 1 week, he regained his consciousness again. And Vasuki pronounced, you now have the strength of 10,000 elephants. No one will be able to defeat you. But I want you to know the circumstance under which you've come here. And he explained, because another of the mystic abilities of the Nagas is they can know events that are at a distance. So he explained the whole thing, the murder plot of Duryodhan. The reason you came here is because you had been poisoned. And explained the whole thing. So Bhima could now understand, whoa, my cousin. Duryodhan, watch out for this man. So they wanted to honor him. They wanted to honor Bhima, so they made an arrangement. They gave him Naga robes. I don't know what they look like, but it doesn't describe Naga robes and a Naga feast. And then Vasuki said, Your family is now in great anxiety. You've been gone for over a week. And they think perhaps you're dead. You think you'd better go back and tell your mother so she doesn't have to worry. Everything's okay. Maybe he's just a teenager. So they sent him back. And in struts Bhima, coming into the royal palace with the power of 10,000 elephants. And everybody's happy except at least two people. Wow, it didn't work. What's this man made of? And in the privacy of the Pandava's chamber, Bhima disclosed the whole wonderful story, but also the diabolical plot of Duryodhana. And of course, being Bhima, he wanted to, like, you know, let Duryodhana have it. And Bhima, Yudhisthira gave different advice. He said, we've just come back to the royal kingdom. We don't really have any standing here. And so, gave two instructions. Don't say anything. And watch out for Duryodhana, because he'll try something else again. And sure enough, he tried something else again. It was poison attempt number two. This time, the poison attempt number two was informed by, I don't know how to pronounce his name, the 101st son of Dhritarashtra. What's his name? Starts with a G. Gotakchak or something like that. Gadachak. Huh? Gatochchak. Something like that. He's the one. Because like Vidura, he was produced as the son of a Shudra, Shudrani. And so he was privy to all the stuff that was going on in the royal palace like Vidura was, and he said, guess what? They're going to try it again. Bhima said, let them try it again. Bring on the meal. And he devoured the whole meal and nothing happened. I'm shortening a long story. So, meanwhile, Bhima, Yudhisthira, Arjuna, they were growing and growing of age. So the elders in the Kuru dynasty, Dronacharya and Bhishma and Kripa, they were discussing amongst themselves, time has come to crown Yudhisthira as prince regent, meaning like incumbent king. It's like there's no turning back after that happens. So they made that, they had the discussion, they informed Dhritarashtra, what could he do? So he accepted. The ceremony was performed, and Duryodhana was more fried. So what to do? Now there's this increasing tension. Dhritarashtra called one of his Brahmin counselors and asked his advice what to do. This counselor gave the advice, there's only one thing I can think that you can do at this time. And that is send the Pandavas away. Then there may be some opportunity to regain, reconsolidate your strength, perhaps do away with them or whatever the needful thing is. It's like diplomacy, diabolical diplomacy. So Dhritarashtra accepted that wisdom, understanding the whole thing, the recommendation that was made. Then Duryodhana came to his father with a specific plan. When they're away, let's create a situation that we can kill them. He disclosed the whole murder plot that was in his mind. And Dhritarashtra was very much against it. How, this is terrible. Stop speaking this way. These are the sons of my brother Pandu cared for me so affectionately. When I was growing up and I was blind, he cared for me every step. And now his sons, they're entitled to the throne. How can I even consider such a thing? But the evil-minded Duryodhan knew the weakness of his father. His father wanted to be king. Or at least he wanted that his sons would become king. So that's the Prabhupada said, anytime a good person becomes bad, we know that there's some bad association. Somewhere, there's been some bad association. So in this case, the bad association for Dhritarashtra was his own son. And his weakness was his attachment. Blind vision, and he became blinded by his attachment. And this is certainly a theme in so many descriptions in scriptures and also in life. When people become attached to something, their higher nature disappears and their lower nature prevails. The nature of attachment is insidious. It steals away all good things in one's life. So that's what happened. Duryodhan knew how to get his father. The father started with the position of no. And then it was silence. And then it was okay. The words of Duryodhan are very nasty. It just twisted the mind of his father. But his father listened. So then they called Parochana. Parochana was one of the most trusted ministers of Dhritarashtra. They informed him of the plan, and he said, I'll take the job. I'll create a house which is made from ghee and oil and wood that's soaked in black, and then we'll cover it up with mud so you won't be able to see it or smell it. But when fire is touched, instantly the place will burn. I'll get the job done, and you can count on me. So, Vidura, because he was a member of the... It was an inner plot, but you know how these things are. We can't keep secrets in ISKCON either. You can't keep secrets in Hastinapur. The plot became known by Vidura. And so, the Pandavas, they knew the diabolical nature of Duryodhan. They knew that there's something, whatever the something was, they weren't certain, but something wicked. So when the invitation was given, why don't you go to this, we'll create a nice summer home for you and you can take a little vacation. You know, you've been under so much difficulty, your father's gone, and just take a night. There's a wonderful festival that the dynasty has traditionally taken part in. You will create a Varanavata. Is that the right pronunciation? Varanavata. That's the town, so nobody knows. Varanavata, as far as I know. That's the town where this house of lac was built. So that's where this very traditional family festival takes place. You can preside over that, and we'll build a nice residence for you. See you later. Prochin will take care of everything. And as they were leaving, Vidura came speaking in a dialect that nobody but Yudhishthira and he understood, a aborigine dialect. And I want to read to you the words that he spoke. One who knows there are sharp weapons capable of cutting the body, although not made of metal, is not injured by them. And then he stopped And Yudhisthira nodded. Nobody understood what was going on. Then Vidura continued, "He survives who understands that the consumer of wood and straw does not reach the dwellers of a hole in the forest." Yudhisthira nodded. "Always stay alert. One who keeps his senses under control can never be overcome by any enemy." That was it. That was his message. And the Pandavas departed in a grand procession. Somewhere down the road, Kunti asked Yudhisthira, "What was that? What did he say? Yudhisthira said, "I'll tell you later." When they were in a secluded place, he explained, "Vidura gave me indication that the plan is for us to be killed by fire. And the way that we can avoid that fire is through a tunnel. So I trust Vidura and his wisdom. Let us go." And when they reached the place, Purochana was there. "Oh, see how fine this came out, and I hope you're comfortable. I'll stay with you for a while and make sure everything works out right for you." And sometime after they became situated, one person came to the door, and he indicated that he was sent by Vidura, and that he was formerly engaged as a miner. Miner meaning one who digs a mine, like a coal mine or whatever it is. And Yudhisthira was thinking, who knows, this may be another trick of Duryodhan. But then the person indicated that he was sent by Vidura, and he told the same message. And said, "In fact, Vidura wants you to know that on the new moon night of this Pashupat festival, that's when they plan to kill you. And Purochana himself is going to set the fire." So Yudhisthira said, "Okay, come on in." And the miner was immediately given the engagement of beginning to dig the tunnel. So from the house, a tunnel that would lead towards the river. So he was busy tunnel digging while the Pandavas were busy concerning themselves with what's the next thing that Duryodhan's going to do. So the day of the festival came, they went out and participated in the festival. That same evening, the person that was in care of the house let some visitors stay in the house, some village people that had some intoxication, and they fell asleep in the house, intoxicated. And rather than wait for Purochana to set fire to the house that night, that one of the Pandavas set fire to the house, and they quickly went through the tunnel. So when the house was burned down, they found the body of a woman and her five sons. That was the people who had spent that night in the house. The Pandavas didn't know that they were there, otherwise they wouldn't have let that happen. But everyone assumed, oh, the Pandavas and Kunti are dead. And they went through this tunnel, went to the other side. There was a boat waiting. The boatman also informed that he was sent by Vidura. He'd been there for months, all night long, just waiting for them to come. Took them across the river downstream and sent them off into a forest. And so all day long, they were traveling. They became tired. Bhima picked them up, carried them on his shoulders. Hercules. And then when nightfall came, they went all night long. The next morning, everyone was asleep. Bhima took some rest. Then it was morning. Hidimba, the Rakshasa, this is mentioned, the cannibals. "My dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poison cake, from a great fire, from cannibals." So Rakshasa Hidimba and his sister Hidimbi. Hidimbi was sent by Hedimba, he could smell breakfast in the air. Human flesh. He hadn't had some good human flesh in a long time. He was very enthusiastic. I'll get ready. You go take care of finding them. Hedimbi, seeing Bhima, who was guarding the Pandavas, became lusty in attraction for Bhima. She had assumed a human-like, a very beautiful human-like form, not a Rakshasi form. And she informed Bhima that her brother, Rakshasa brother, wanted to come and eat them. So please come with me. I'll take you to a celestial place. So the long series of events took place. Bhima said, "No way. I'm not afraid of any Rakshasa. Let him come and I'll, you know, tear him to pieces." "No, you don't understand. He has this, he's so powerful. He has a special benediction that he can't be killed in an ordinary way." "No problem. Let him come." And so Hedimba came, and big battle, and Bhima was victorious. Real intense battle. Real intense battle. By that time, the Pandavas were awake and watching the battle. "Wow, look at that one. Look at that one." Arjuna said, "I'll take care of him. You can take rest for a while." "No way. I'm going to..." Just wanted to fire up Bhima even more. Once nightfall's coming, and you know what happens when Rakshasas in nightfall, they get their strength intensifies many times. "So you better finish him off. So quit playing around." So he finished. And then Hedimbi made the proposal that Bhima, she wanted to tag along, and then it was she wanted to marry Bhima. Anyway, so it was settled. She would marry Bhima. He agreed on the condition that when a son was born, then that son, he would then be able to leave her. So actually, I may have names mixed up. What is the name of that son? Okay. So there was another son of Dhritarashtra born in that way. Okay. Yeah, I thought so. He later became an important person in the Kurukshetra battle. Bhima's son. Some other name, some other person informed of the poison. From the vicious assembly, well, I think what I'm going to do is I'll stop the Mahabharata narration for the moment, let you do a little translating. Those that want to take breakfast can take breakfast. We'll take a little breakfast break and resume. Try to remember the theme, how it connects with Srimad Bhagavatam. These are examples that Kunti is pointing to of the Muhur Vipad Ganat, the continuous series of difficulties. Now, not even a blade of grass will move without Krishna's sanction. So the difficulties couldn't have come without Krishna's sanction. But as the Pandavas were going through those difficulties, as Kunti was experiencing all of this, her understanding was Krishna is our protector. And this next incident is also extremely apparent. How Draupadi was protected by Krishna by supplying unlimited sari. So, my dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us, in this case, from the vicious assembly. As the time was approaching for the Pandavas' coronation, Duryodhan, conspiring with Shakuni, decided there's a way to take away everything from them. Because Yudhisthira is virtuous, he'll never deny, as a Kshatriya, the opportunity for some competition. And you're very expert in dice. Yudhisthira has no experience with dice. Let's engage them in some competition and take away everything through gambling. And so that plan was executed, and Yudhisthira, on religious unrighteous principle, would not deny the opportunity for competition. And everything was lost. They themselves were lost. Their kingdom was lost. Their wealth was lost. Finally, Draupadi was lost. And a messenger was sent to Draupadi to bring her into the assembly. Duryodhan issued that order. So, when Draupadi received that message, her reply, I'm going to read some of this now. Go back to the hall, O messenger, and ask that gambler who has lost even himself if he is still my lord, if he was still my lord when I was staked. When I know the answer to this, I shall go with a sorrowful heart. So she's asking somebody who's already has lost themselves by religious principle, can they give away something else? The servant then went back and informed the assembly what Draupadi has said. So she had this question. Nobody said anything. Yudhisthira said nothing. He shook his head from side to side, seeming as if demented or deprived of his reason. Duryodhan smiled slightly. Let Draupadi come here and ask her question directly to Yudhisthira. We shall all hear his reply. So the messenger went back, told Draupadi what had been said. Here's Draupadi's reply. He who is the greatest ordainer of the world has ordained this without doubt. Happiness and misery come in turn to both the wise and the unwise. Morality is said, however, to be the highest objective in this world. If we preserve morality, it will pour blessings upon us. Let not that morality now abandon the Kurus. Go back, O Sutta, and speak these words to the virtuous Kuru elders. I am ready to obey whatever command those moral-minded men may give, for they are conversant with all the precepts of virtue. The servant went back a third time, second time. The Pandavas all looked to the Kuru elders, who remained silent. They knew that what was happening was terrible. But they couldn't speak to address the intricacy of what in this situation was moral and not moral. Was it right? Because they couldn't speak other than virtue, and they were, even Bhima, Vishuddhi Bhishma, was unable to discern. Then said to the servant, go to the bitterly weeping Anjali and tell her that she should appear here, even though she is in seclusion and attired in only a single cloth. This is Duryodhan's command. The Pandavas looked up at the Kuru elders, who even after hearing Yudhisthira's words, all remained silent. The brothers could not determine what to do. They were ready to challenge Duryodhana and his 100 brothers in a fight, but seeing Yudhisthira still silent, they did not move. Bhima, however, could barely contain himself. And Arjuna, breathing like a serpent, seemed to be on fire. Duryodhana laughed, enjoying every moment of his victory. He again addressed the messenger. Go, O Suta, and fetch the princess. She now has Yudhisthira's order. The servant looked perplexed. He was always obedient to Duryodhana, but he feared Draupadi's anger. He spoke hesitantly. What shall I say to the queen for the third time? Duryodhana snorted angrily. He turned to Dushasana. O brother, this foolish servant is afraid of Bhima. Go and bring Draupadi here. What can the Pandavas do now that they have become dependent on our will? So, Dushasana charged like a dog and went straight to Draupadi's room. Come, O princess, for we have won you honestly. Cast aside your modesty and go before your new master, Duryodhana. O beautiful lady, you must accept the Kauravas as your lords. Draupadi stood up, weeping loudly. She covered her pale face with her hands and ran towards Gandhari's chambers. Dushasana roared in anger and ran after her. He grabbed hold of her long, wavy hair and forcibly pulled her along with him. As he dragged Draupadi by her bluish locks, the shameless prince recalled how that same hair had been sprinkled with the sanctified water of the Rajasuya. Ignoring her plaintive cries, he pulled her out into the palace passageways. Draupadi spoke to him in a low voice. O rude one, O wretch, you shall not take me before the assembly. How can I appear there in my present condition, dressed only in a single cloth? Dushasana laughed. It does not matter, O Panchali, whether you are attired in one cloth or naked, for we have won you, and you must come now to live amongst our servant women as best you can. The Kaurava then dragged the wailing Draupadi into the assembly hall. She prayed piteously to Krishna and Arjuna. Dushasana threw her before Duryodhana, where she fell with her cloth in disarray and her hair disheveled. The Kuru elders could hardly look at her. Bhishma, Drona, and Vidura were unable to maintain their composure, and they wept openly. Dhritarashtra asked, what is happening now? Is the Panchala princess here? Then Draupadi rose up like a flame and addressed the assembly in an angry voice. All the persons in this assembly are learned in the scriptures and devoted to sacrifice. Some are my elders and gurus. How can I stand before them in this state? The high-souled son of Dharma is bound by the subtle rules of morality. Only those with clear vision can understand those rules. I am therefore unable to admit even an atom of fault in my husband. Draupadi looked toward Dhritarashtra, her eyes filled with tears. By his side, she saw Bhima, Drona, and Vidura, their faces torn in anguish. Everyone remained silent as she continued to reprimand them. How do you all say nothing if this wretched dog's dragging me into the hall? Surely, then, you have all the same mind. Shame on you. The Kuru's high morality has been destroyed by this act. Drona, Bhishma, Katwa, and the king have lost their own greatness, for none of them condemned this most vile deed. Draupadi then fell to the floor, crying in helplessness and distress. The slender-waisted princess glanced at her enraged husbands. They were incensed to see her in such a state, and her glance inflamed them even more. Even the loss of their kingdom and wealth did not pain them as much as Draupadi's glance, which was full of modesty and anger. When Dushasana saw Draupadi look at her husbands, however, he again dragged her toward the Kurus. Slave! Slave! He shouted. Duryodhana, Karna, and Shakuni all applauded Dushasana and laughed along with him. Apart from those three, everyone else in the hall was afflicted with sorrow to see the princess treated in this way. Shaking his head, Bhishma fought back tears and said to Draupadi, "Oh, blessed lady, knowing that one who has no wealth of his own cannot stake that belonging to others, but knowing also that wives are always at the command of their husbands, I am unable to answer the point you raised, the point that she wanted to know. Did my husband own me when he gambled me, or was because he had given himself he had no possessions and couldn't give any possessions? The ways of morality are subtle. Yudhisthira can abandon the whole world full of wealth, but he will never sacrifice morality. The Pandavas played with Shakuni, even though he knew that no one could defeat him in dice. He has staked and lost both himself and you, O princess. Therefore, I am confused upon this matter." This is the Mahajan Bhishma speaking. Bhishma looked at Dhritarashtra, but the king remained ever silent. Draupadi spoke again. "Yudhisthira was summoned to this assembly by the king, and though he does not possess skill in dice, he was made to play with a skillful, wicked, and deceitful gambler. How then can he be held to have staked anything voluntarily? He has been deprived of his senses by the contrivances of sinful men acting together. This act lacks all propriety and will be condemned by all wise men. Here in this hall are many leaders of the Bharata race. Let them reflect on my words and answer my question." Dushasana began to harshly insult Draupadi. She wept grievously and looked toward her helpless husbands. Bhima was afflicted beyond endurance. Finally, giving vent to his anger, he said to Yudhisthira, "I'm not going to read it," he says, I'm going against you. "I consider your gambling with Draupadi abominable. Having obtained us as her husbands, this innocent girl does not deserve to suffer in this way. Only because of you is she now being persecuted by these low, despicable, cruel, and mean-minded Kurus. Although you are my lord, I can hardly control my anger towards you." Bhima turned his massive shoulders towards the twins. "I shall now burn Yudhisthira's hands. Sahadev, bring fire." Arjun quickly caught hold of his brother. "Oh, Bhima, do not speak this way. You've never uttered such words before. Your morality has certainly been destroyed by these cruel foes. Do not fulfill our enemy's wishes. Practice the highest virtue and remain obedient to your elder brother. Remembering a Kshatriya's duties, he has played today only on the king's command and against his own desire. Such an act will surely make him famous." Bhima calmed himself. Checked by Arjuna's reproach, he felt ashamed. "You are right, O Dhananjaya. Our brother has surely acted in accordance with duty. Had I not known this, I would long ago have snatched his arms and burnt them in a blazing fire." Both brothers looked at Yudhisthira in distress. They knew he felt obliged by the presence of Dhritarashtra and Bhishma. If those two elders did not speak out against what was happening, then Yudhisthira would not object to the proceedings. Duryodhana hardly laughed. He was relishing his cousin's discomfort. He was especially enjoying Draupadi's distress, remembering how she had laughed at him at the Maya Sabha. And they finally, Vikarna, Dhritarashtra's son, spoke out, "O king, O kings, answer Draupadi's question. If we do not decide a matter referred to us in the royal assembly, then we shall all descend into hell. Dhritarashtra, Bhishma, Vidura, you're the eldest of the Kurus, yet you say nothing. Why are Drona and Kripa silent? Let the kings who have assembled here from all directions leave aside their anger and give Draupadi a reply. The cardinal looked around the assembly, but still nobody spoke. He repeatedly asked that Draupadi's question should be answered. Had she been one or not? Was she now the core of a slave? The silence in the great hall was broken only by Draupadi's sobs. After another agonizing minute had passed in silence, Vikarna said, "If no one will respond, then I shall say what I consider just and proper. O best of men, it is said that there are four vices to which kings are prone. Hunting, drinking, womanizing, and gambling. The man addicted to these vices lives by forsaking virtue. Therefore, that which is performed by one under the sway of any of these sins cannot be taken seriously. Madly under the influence of gambling and urged by the sinful Shakuni Yudhisthira staked this princess. She belongs to all the Pandavas and was lost after Yudhisthira had already lost himself. Nor was Yudhisthira playing the game willingly. Rather, the king invited him here to oblige him to play an unfair match. Considering all this, I say that Draupadi has not been won." As Karna sat down, the assembly was in an uproar. Practically everyone applauded him and censured Shakuni. Then Karna spoke. Karna, like Duryodhan, still remembered his humiliation when Draupadi refused to allow him to compete in her swayambar. The pain of that refusal still rankled. Then he spoke. Whew. And then, let's get to the punchline. Bound by morality. Oh, no, so, what Karna said is they should remove their royal garments. They are no longer kings. Bound by morality, the Pandavas slowly removed their upper garments and threw them down. They sat silently as Dushasana approached the wailing Draupadi. The Kaurava took hold of the end of her cloth and pulled on it forcefully. Draupadi held her sari tightly in an attempt to protect herself, but it was useless. Her strength was nothing compared to Dushasana's. She looked again at her five husbands. It was obvious that they could not help her. As Dushasana pulled harder, she looked around the hall like a frightened deer assailed by a lion. There was only one person now who could save her. Krishna. The Supreme Personality saw everything and was always her shelter. Draupadi fixed her mind on Krishna, threw up both her hands and cried, "Oh, Govinda, oh, Keshava, oh, beloved of the gopis and lord of Vrindavan, oh, Janardana, you are the destroyer of all affliction. I am sinking into the Kuru ocean, oh, lord, oh, soul of universe, oh, creator of the world. Save me, who am distressed and losing my senses in this assembly." From where he was seated in Dwaraka, Krishna heard Draupadi's piteous cries. He expanded himself by his inconceivable power and went swiftly to Hastinapur. By his mystic potency, he immediately entered the assembly hall. Without being seen by anyone, he provided Draupadi with an unlimited supply of cloth to cover her. Dushasana pulled and pulled at her sari, and as he did so, the princess spun around, but he could not disrobe her. There seemed to be no end to her sari. The astonished prince pulled with even more strength, but Draupadi remained covered. Soon, a large heap of cloth lay piled on the floor. Seeing this wonderful event, all the kings praised Draupadi and censured Dushasana. The prince was exhausted from his futile attempt to undress the Pandava's wife. He sat down, perspiring heavily. Bhima leapt up and raised his arms. "O king, O kings of this world," he thundered, "listen to my words. I shall now make a vow unlike any that has been made before, nor shall such a vow be made in the future. If I do not forcibly tear open the breast of this sinful wretch on the battlefield and drink his blood, then I may not obtain the path of my ancestors." Hearing Bhima's terrible words, the king applauded him and again censured Dushasana. A clamor arose. Shouts of shame, shame fill the hall. Vidura once more brought silence to the hall. He turned to Dhritarashtra and Bhishma. O learned men, you do not answer Draupadi's question, and thus, in this assembly, we persecute religion. And so on goes on. He insists that Dhritarashtra give the answer to her question. He isn't saying anything. Then Duryodhan slaps his thigh and tells Draupadi, come sit on my thigh. And then Bhima makes his vow and break his thighs. Finally, Dhritarashtra speaks. And Dhritarashtra says, oh, noble princess. This has gone too far. I want to give you a benediction. Please ask whatever you like. He doesn't answer the question. Give you a benediction, whatever you like. The benediction she asks is that that Yudhisthira be released from this boss of the gambling match. He's no longer the sold-out slave of the Kauravas. He says, yes, ask for another one. So my other husbands also. It is done. Ask for a third one. She says, I can't ask for a third one. It's not proper. Asking for three benedictions. He says that my noble husbands are released from this. Because if they're just carried by their own virtue, then all success will prevail in this world for the cause of righteousness. And they leave the assembly. So we've all seen the pictures. Krishna's up in the sky somewhere and supplying the sari. But according to Mahabharata, he personally came to do that, not seen, just as we were hearing Kunti in her prayers. Krishna, although he's Antar and Bahir, he's not seen. So he chose to not be seen, but he supplied unlimited sari to protect Draupadi in the vicious assembly. And to complete the verse, from sufferings during our exile in the forest. Now we'd have to narrate half of Mahabharata to go through that, so just so many difficulties again and again and again. Difficulties. Being in the forest has its difficulties. So many difficulties. And each time, just like the Duryodhan sending Durvasamuni at a particular time when they wouldn't have anything to offer him, so they would get the wrath of Durvasamuni, and Krishna personally protected them again and again. Whether it was obvious that he was personally there or through investing special powers in Arjuna or Yudhisthira in form of wisdom, whatever that energy or ability or strength or capacity was, it was given by Krishna. They understood that. Although in difficulty, they understood Krishna's protection is always there. And from the battle where great generals fought, this reading in the scenes of battle, such intense fighting, awareness, Arjuna understood in a later chapter, when he returns back to Dwaraka, back to Hastinapur, after accompanying Krishna to Dwaraka, that although he had the strength to defeat practically single-handedly the whole Kaurava army, when that need for that strength was no longer there, Krishna removed that strength and he couldn't even protect the wives of Krishna from cowherds. Where was that? Where did that strength come from? And the ability to use that strength in a proper way came from Krishna. And the incident that just took place in the seventh chapter, just before this eighth chapter, is the release of the Brahmastra weapon. And Krishna personally protected the child within the womb of Uttara. And so Kunti is offering her prayers to Krishna as their soul shelter and protector. Very feelingly, she's offering these prayers. And how it is that one can feelingly offer prayers is a key part of this theme, a key theme of this section. As long as one has other shelters besides Krishna, difficulty is always going to come. This is the material world, in case you hadn't noticed. And there's always something. If it's not something, it's 10 somethings, but there's always something. There's some difficulty, always. And where does one's attention go when difficulty comes? For souls like Kunti and Draupadi and her husbands, the Pandavas, and such pure devotees of the Lord, there's only one place that the mind goes. To Krishna. And when Krishna hears the sincere call of the devotee that has no other shelter but him, his protection is always going to be there. That's the nature of Krishna's personality. He never abandons his devotee. We abandon him. But he doesn't abandon us. We turn our backs to him, but he never turns our backs to us. So, the conclusion of the chapter will, I guess, the conclusion of this section of verses comes next. But certainly a very, very important part of Kunti's prayers. Her life was filled with distress or hardship. But in that hardship, Krishna was always near, certainly always dear to her and the Pandavas. Besides Gandhari's 100 sons, Dhritarashtra had conceived another son by a servant maid who had waited on him during his wife's lengthy pregnancy. Unlike his half-brothers, this boy, Yuyutsu, felt no envy or antagonism towards the Pandavas. One day he secretly informed Yudhisthira that Duryodhan, who had been deeply disappointed to see that his plan to kill Bhima had failed, had again cooked up a large quantity of deadly datura, poison, into Bhima's enormous meal. Bhima laughed when he heard the news. He sat down before Duryodhan and cheerfully consumed the entire quantity of poison food. Duryodhan was amazed to see that Bhima was not the least affected. He gazed at the Pandavas with open hatred. So, we've been here for 3 hours in one posture. I know I could use a little stretch. So we'll take a 10-minute break. We'll have a little kirtan. We'll continue. The situation where Krishna was now just about to leave Hastinapur. We went into some of the details. And then just before Krishna's departure, her prayers. prayers are not exactly to ask Krishna to stay, although certainly that's what she wants, that Krishna would stay. But she also understands, Prabhupada wrote that a pure devotee such as Kunti would never ask Krishna for something for themselves. It's just the nature of pure devotion. But the prayer that is coming at the very end of this whole series of prayers is the prayer for pure devotion. Devotion is not mixed by any material affinity for anything. So that's like at the heart of all these prayers. And now the remaining section of this cluster of verses that we're discussing this morning, she directly touches on that point. So the theme of this section is that difficulty, distress, calamity has a purpose, there's a spiritual purpose behind such things in the life of a devotee. And that is, it brings about a condition of helplessness, and that helplessness state, remembrance of Krishna becomes intensified. And the clear sense that there is no shelter, just like the classic of Draupadi. Draupadi was certainly not an ordinary woman in any sense, even in physical strength. Draupadi was very strong. But Dushyasana was far stronger. So as Dushyasana was holding on her sari with one hand, she was holding on to her sari in the other hand, calling out for assistance. And when she realized that was futile, that the Kauravas would not help her, the Pandavas would not help her, because of the complexity of the situation. So with both hands raised in the air, Hey Krishna, Hey Govinda, Oh Janardhan. Please give me your shelter. So the next verse is perhaps one of the most famous verses in all of these prayers of Queen Kunti.